Italian Wine Podcast. Cin cin with Italian wine people.
This is the Italian Wine Podcast with me, Rebecca Lawrence, once again taking the reins from Monty Walden. And actually, it's a bit of a, not only a female takeover of the podcast, but a British female takeover of the podcast. This episode, because I am honoured to be joined by Amelia Singer, an award-winning wine educator and expert on The Wine Show, which many of you, I hope, have watched on TV. So, Amelia, welcome to the Italian Wine Podcast.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So, Amelia, before we dive into the discussion that you had at Wine to Wine and maybe see if we can take it a little bit deeper for listeners to the podcast, what was it that initially drew you to the wine industry? Did you come to wine like straight out of the gate, or were you lured to the wine industry from another profession?
I kind of was seduced by my father into the industry. Like, he is European and pretty much weaned me on wine from age six. He would always allow me to have a sip of wine before dinner, and then I'd give him, like, I'd have to like try and describe the flavors, and he actually burst into tears at age 10 when I described a Viognier as having peach, honey and apricot notes. And he's like, that's the perfect tasting note. I didn't actually saying that. It was very much a father-daughter thing, and actually the first bottle of wine I remember sharing with him was actually in Italy. It wasn't just me sharing a bottle with him. It was like a family meal, and I was like 14, and I was actually allowed a full glass of Amarone on holiday in Italy. Yeah, so he kind of got me excited about wine and really thinking about wine as one of life's greatest enhancers. You know, we'd have these long family meals and great conversations, and it's like all life enhancers, like good music and good books, all that kind of thing. So he kind of got me very comfortable with it, but it was only really when I was at university and I thought I was going to be an actress. So I was spending lots of time acting and singing and studying English literature. But I helped set up the Food and Wine Society there, we'll help run it. And I really loved all the wine tastings going on. And it was in Dublin in Ireland. And not many of my friends came from wine drinking families. But I suddenly realized there I would throw these wine and cheese nights at my flat, which at first everyone ridiculed me for. And I was like, look, guys, just bring a bottle of wine, bring some cheese. It could be Baby Bell, who cares? And let's just, you know, like have fun. And that, it was when I was there, I actually, people started, at first they ridiculed me and then they came along and they're like, oh my gosh, no, this is actually really fun and cool. And it just made me realize, gosh, you know, wine, why does it have to be such an elitist intellectual subject? It's really just about getting the right tone and messaging and communication. And people, then everyone can see it's one of life's greatest enhancers. And at university too, it was when kind of Jamie Oliver was in his prime and I really loved what he was doing with food. And I remember going back my last year at uni to a Christmas party and someone talking to me about wine, and I said, I just really hate the strict dichotomy with wine, where I think of it as either very elitist or they're like just pissed on three bottles of Jacob's Creek. Why can't there be someone like a Jamie Oliver of wine and really empower people when it comes to making decisions? And this guy was really bored of my chat and said, well, why don't you do it then? And I was like, oh my gosh, yes. And it just kind of, it was, it was 2008. And I remember telling my father on Christmas Eve, yeah, Dad, like, I have to tell you something. And he's like, uh-oh, because it could be really anything with me. And I was like, yeah, I no longer want to be an actress. I actually want to go into wine. And he burst into tears. And he said, I'm so happy for you. I would have supported if you wanted to be an actress. But I think going into wine will make you far happier and give you a far more rewarding life. And he's right about that. No regrets.
Nice story. Oh, that's so lovely. It really makes sense because you are such a good presenter of wines that like the acting training and your kind of natural ability to just make some wine something that is really approachable, I think has been such a great thing. Like, you've definitely inspired me on my wine journey to do that kind of thing, to remember that like, wine is something that you can have fun with. It doesn't, like you say, there doesn't have to be this dichotomy with it. There can be this fantastic middle ground. And talking about the food and wine pairing, you actually enjoy pairing wine with music, I understand. So I wondered if you could share some pairings or some inspiration that you're particularly proud of when it comes to wine and music pairing.
It's like, I ultimately want to be considered the cross-dresser of booze, because for me, I love...
Okay, that's it, everyone. That's Amelia's new hashtag, the cross-dresser of booze.
Because ultimately, again, it fits into that whole communication thing. Like, I hate there being binaries. I hate there being strict brackets with things. And really, it's just about understanding your audience, making them think, okay, like, they might really love music. So if you talk about, you know, I love doing wine and music events, wine and art events, wine and literature events, wine and philosophy events. Because for me, I love it because, like, creatively it gets me to think about wine in interesting ways and gets me re-engaged with it in, like, an exciting dimension. But then it's going to make wine lovers who normally think of seeing wine, you know, in one linear way, they see maybe favorites of theirs, you know, kind of in a whole new way. And then people who would never normally engage with wine at these kind of events or whatever, they suddenly see their art form or their interest being represented in vineous form. And so it makes them engage with wine in a way which makes them feel comfortable and excited and just kind of enhances their mind. And, like, that for me, that's what wine is about. It is a life enhancer. So the wine and music, I definitely find I find it the easiest out of all the cross-dressing I do. Not to take that quote out of context. But yeah, just because, again, I think sensorially, the way that wine and music works, you know, I always give the example, you know, so much of wine is, like, you know, it's smell and scent and perfume, and 90% of what you taste, what you smell. It's amazing how you suddenly smell something or taste something and it'll bring up kind of amazingness, some kind of memory or remind you of something. Same thing is kind of said for music. You could be walking down a street and suddenly you hear a tune playing or whatever, and it'll just... suddenly you'll get this arresting, like, flashback or memory or association. So I think just in terms of how they work, I find it the easiest. Also probably because I used to sing jazz and blues and play the piano, so maybe I just I love to work with the two. But for me, probably the pairings I've felt the most proud of is doing for genres of music which I'm not that knowledgeable in, like really going outside my comfort zone. So for example, I got a call 2 years ago to do the interpretation of Kanye West through Spanish wine in an art gallery in Laguna Beach in California. So, like, that for me, like, I really, you know, I did listen to, like, hip-hop a little bit at school and things like that, like, but it really is not a genre I I can pretend to be an expert or connoisseur on. And that for me, it was really fun, and I really had to, like, think about wines and how then the wines could be represented through Kanye West as his music, but also as a producer, and then how that could be reflected in art. And, like, that for me, that was super, super fun. And again, I guess more recently, was actually filming the last bit of film we did for the Wine Show Series 3. Thank goodness we managed to film in February and managed to wrap everything up. We were so lucky with timing. But it was when I was in New York and I was being interviewed by Jermaine Stone, who has a wine and hip hop podcast.
One of my friends, Jermaine Stone, the Wolf of Wine.
Oh, he's so amazing. We've done quite a few things together now, but the first time I met him was in New York for this wine show filming in February. And I was really nervous because I was like, oh my God, like, I'm a wine person. I'm not a hip hop person. And immediately I was doing the thing which I always tell people never to do, you know, like, there doesn't need to be these binaries, you know, blah, blah, blah. But I was really, really nervous. And actually, he's just how he does it. Like, he considers himself a wine culturalist. And he also is a cross-dresser, you know, even though he might not call himself that. But what he's doing with his wine and hip-hop podcast is exactly that. And engaging with communities who would maybe view wine in a very set way and whatever. But he's actually really able to break down barriers. I love his ethos. Anyway, we actually end up having the best conversation. He suddenly played a song and I was able to tune it, like, pair it with an amazing Chardonnay, which I discovered earlier in the day at a urban New York winery with Andre Mack, who also is a hero of mine. So yeah, no, it was really fun because I was like, oh no. And I was like, absolutely, because I just basically said, look, I just said to him in the interview, I was just like, okay, I don't know what to look for with hip hop. So can you tell me, like, break down the three things I should look for? And it's exactly how when I do a wine tasting, I always start my wine tastings with, these are kind of my own three principles of wine tasting. I mean, they're not terribly serious. I mean, it's like swirly, swirly, sniffy, sniffy, slurpy, slurpy. But, you know, like, you know, based on those three principles, I kind of can go through the tasting. And that's effectively, like, he did it in his own vernacular with hip hop. And I was like, oh my gosh. And from doing that, I could then listen to the song and then I could find the right wine. And it was just case in point how all of these things, I do consider wine to be one of the arts. They're meant to bring people together and give you joy and, yeah, see things in whole new, exciting light. So yeah, that was for me, like, a really, really affirmative tasting and pairing.
I really love the way that he quite often approaches his kind of music and wine pairing from this idea of the mood that is created. Like you say, this like sensorial aspect of wine is not just in what we smell and what we taste, but it's connected to so many other things. And like he really approaches it from mood. And I think that's such a nice way to think about wine with people, particularly people who are worried that wine might be quite elitist and don't know how to approach it. It's like, well, what do you feel like drinking on this occasion? Like, what mood are you in? And we can take it from there. And I think that's also like these kind of pairings, these cultural pairings, in many ways are kind of the foundation of wine, and we got a little bit lost from it. Because if you think back to things like, you know, the Greek and Roman appreciation of wine, it was so tied in with culture. So actually, it was always there. It's just, I love that people like yourself and Jermaine are bringing it to the fore again.
Yeah, and it's meant to be fun too, you know. And I just, again, I think unfortunately fairly recently, I mean, I went into the wine industry 12 years ago because I just was like, oh my gosh, like why do people have to think of it as this very elitist intellectual thing? And it just seemed like so sad. I do think non-Anglophone countries are better at like with like kind of drinking, like, you know, like kind of in terms of associating wine with food and good conversation. And like when I think of my French and Italian and Spanish friends, like how they were brought up with wine seems much more healthy than I would say in the England and definitely in the US. Oh my gosh, the prohibition has a lot to answer for in this country.
Well, speaking of the US, you've actually been stuck in LA for most of 2020, which I can imagine has huge pros and cons. But also you must have been within quite the heart of social change that's going on. Have you kind of felt and seen the impact of social change while you've been there this year?
I think LA is up there, and probably if you're going to see the most social change and see it literally in ground zero, LA would be one of the main cities, if not the you know, the real, I mean, I can also think of Portland. I can also think, but the thing is, LA has always been known as a city for kind of protests and, you know, being liberal, being able to express yourself. And obviously the Me Too movement really kicked off here 2 years ago. And then this year, absolutely. I mean, it's just been such a tinderbox with COVID, with it, of course, being election year. I mean, that's really affected everything. It'd be very interesting to see how the media portrayed COVID if it was not election year, but that's another conversation. And then, of course, the whole BLM movement. And where I live, West Hollywood, I mean, I had tanks outside my door. I had SWAT teams in the neighbor's garden. I have asthma. We had to keep the windows shut because of tear gas. I mean, it was like, it was just mad. It was really, and I just, to try and explain, and this had nothing to do with the protests. These were riots. These were, you know, kind of probably white men mainly taking advantage of the fact that it was a very precarious situation here. And, you know, kind of under the cover of BLM movement were actually just being thugs and smashing jewelry stores and, you know, all of my shops and, you know, the local laundrette where I go and the place where I get my milk and all of these places, they all were like, had to be boarded up and they sort of all graffitied on or smashed up. I mean, there was one morning where I woke up and I was like, I wonder what the landscape's going to look like today. You know, it was literally like, I was like, what's going to be smashed in? What's going to be still around? So no, like absolutely. I think LA, it is kind of an epicenter for all kind of these movements, but also where I happened to be placed was just ground zero. And I mean, but then I was talking to my landlords who also live in the same kind of garden area. And, you know, they were here in the 1990s when there were kind of protests then. And they're like, you know, it's a very tumultuous, but at the same time, very inspiring city in a lot of ways. I mean, it was scary, I'm not going to lie, when the tanks started to roll in from Beverly Hills and we had to have them here for about 4 or 5 days. But yeah, you are really on, you know, the you've got the front row seats, basically, of these movements. Yeah, yeah, no, it's been nuts. But then also because of that, that precipitates, again, like just with social media too, everything gets accelerated anyway. But, you know, then you see people's reactions and you see how people try and move with the change, whether that's trying to raise awareness on their social media platforms or, you know, whether it's been very interesting seeing the kind of stories, even with the Court of Master Sommelier story, which you know, came out this year, like, and that was with the New York Times. Like, it's not just social media accounts, it's even big publications. Like, they suddenly realized, oh no, we have this onus to be engaged and to reflect what is going on. So it really, yeah, things were a catalyst here, and it's really just affected the whole country. And it's just been interesting to see the coverage, the communication, and the different platforms which are kind of evolving because of it.
So speaking of platforms for change, and also things like you bringing up the court and the issues that are currently being brought to light, I think, and or at least being focused on more in our wine industry. I was really impressed in your discussion during Wine to Wine that you were talking about the difference between bullying in the industry and harassment, and this idea that bullying is much harder to pin down than harassment. And I mean, like harassment, but also you can see that it's not limited to gender. Early in your wine career, you were talking about this in the session, but for those who haven't seen it, you experienced a very extreme case of bullying. And often people in such situations, like, they don't see a way out. So I wondered if you could maybe talk a little bit about that experience for those who haven't had the chance to see the session, and then maybe talk about the red flags or warning signs that, unfortunately, you know, you are now aware of, that maybe we can help make other people aware of.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I was 22 when I entered the industry. I was very green and just positive and just wanted to work really hard. And actually, the person who was a bully was female. And I think that was, like, very important to bring up in the session, because, of course, you know, sexual harassment comes up a lot, but actually I think systemic psychological bullying can be just as damaging. And that's what happened to me. And that can happen with a male or female boss. And for me too, like, to be anti-bullying, like, no one should have to suffer bullying, whatever, like, age, gender, race. You know, I just don't want anyone to experience what I went through, which is why I felt like I had to say something on the Wine to Wine webinar when I finally had some kind of platform and some kind of voice. But yeah, I entered, you know, I was, again, I think what also happens in the wine industry is, like, there's not much money going around. It was 2009. It was a company which was, you know, often most wine companies in the industry are kind of small to medium businesses, therefore they're kind of really stretched. So I wasn't really even being paid that much. They'd actually rolled two roles into one. You know, I really had no experience. I come straight from university. I'd done a harvest in Bordeaux, but apart from that, I, you know, came straight from university. And I had this boss who at first seemed so charming and was really wanting to be my best friend and was just like, chummy, 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 chummy. And that's actually a red flag. Like, you don't actually want to be best friends with your boss, you know, and anyone who comes across as too friendly or too familiar, like, there needs to be boundaries there. Because already, yeah, I should have known there was a lack of boundaries and a lack of, yeah, kind of clear-cut lines. Anyway, you know, I ended up, it's a possible situation, trying to do this impossible role, working, like, getting into the office at 6 a.m., working till 10 every day, you know, for, like, pittance, like, literally, like, no money, like, busting a gut, just made myself ill in the process. And, you know, she just, whenever I tried to ask for help, she just sighed, just like, make out that I was, you know, really stupid. When I did do events, she would always take the credit for it. I remember pulling off this, like, big portfolio tasting for the company, and everyone else was like, oh, that was great, that was the best one. And all she said, like, she took the credit for it. And then all she said to me, she thanked me, she just commented on the fact that one of the wines was missing out of 300 and whatever. And that had nothing to do with me. That was, you know, the fact that it just didn't arrive in time from customs or whatever. To even just, you know, we'd go out for client dinners, and I am severely allergic to dairy, but she was too embarrassed if I said anything about, like, my dietary restrictions. So I remember going to this one restaurant in France, and I'd actually called ahead to the restaurant because I didn't want to cause a fuss. I hate causing a fuss, but I'd, like, call them up and said, look, I'm allergic to dairy. Anyway, we sit down at this dinner, and suddenly my plate comes out, and it's, like, covered in butter. And she just kind of shot me this look, and she whispered to me, eat it, because she just did not want me to. And I was up all night, sick. And because I was 22, I did. Like, now at 34, I'm like, oh my God, I would never have let someone tell me to, like, eat something which I knew would make me sick. You know, like, what the hell? But I did, because I was so scared of her. And eventually I was so ill. I had already gone through, like, three different antibiotics, and I almost collapsed on our last day. Like, we were doing a marketing presentation, and then I'd organized the staff Christmas party in the evening. And I actually had to run out of the room at some stage to be sick in a loo. And I took myself off in an Uber to go to the doctor, and the doctor was just like, you're too ill. Like, she way made me. And she's like, you've lost so much weight, you know, da da da. She's like, I don't think you can go back to work. And I was like, no, I need to go back to work. Because I just had the fear, you know, I was like, no, you don't understand. Like, I need to go. And like, I'm running the office party. Like, I just like, it was almost like Stockholm syndrome, you know. I was like, no. Like, I was so sucked into it and so terrified of her. And she's like, well, maybe you can go back for half a day, but I really just, I don't think you're well, and I'm really worried about you. And I remember calling my boss up, being like, look, the doctor's not sure about me coming in, but I can come in for half a day. And she just said to me really coldly, you know, Amelia, there's no point in you coming in. I don't need any broken soldiers around me, and just hung up. And I was absolutely devastated. And in the end, I forced myself to go back after the Christmas break, and the doctor had actually said, I think you're actually really depressed, and I think you're not going to respond to these. I was on my fourth kind of antibiotic, had lost lots of weight, hair was falling out, you know, like, it was not a good look. And eventually I kind of got to the point where she couldn't find me, but I was like, I think I better go. And I think she was just so relieved, like she just like palmed off all these gifts to me, to kind of, and made a big show of like, thank you so much in front of the company. But actually my last day, she wasn't there. And I just sent an email around to everyone in the company, just being like, oh, by the way, like, it's my last day, you know, I'll be at the pub like next door, you know, blah, blah. And I just kind of thought, oh my God. And I felt really stupid. I thought everything, I was like, oh my God, why couldn't I do this job? I'm really stupid. Everyone must hate me, because no one ever stuck up for me. And that's also the thing with bullies too. Like, they operate by creating this, you know, like this ambience of fear and power dynamics, which is just so pervasive and silencing and scary. And it was amazing, the whole office actually turned up to the pub later that day because she wasn't there, and they could like show their support for me. It was so weird. And they were like, oh my gosh, we're so sad to see you leave, like, you're the most positive thing in this office, you know, we've had 10 people leave in the last 2 years because of her, two of them are threatened to sue because of her bullying and like racism. And but they only told me on my last day. And so like, I think this is what happens, like, you start, when you're a victim of this, you're like, oh, it's all me. And I think, you know, particularly I think young women too, or whatever, and it's your first job, and like, you just, you know, you're just like, oh yeah, it must be my fault why things haven't worked out and why this person is treating me this way. And there was no HR resource in the company, and there was nowhere really I could have gone. And I think that's like a big issue for the industry, because often these small to medium-sized businesses, which is how the wine industry works, they don't have the capacity for you to, you know, and there's no way for you to know your rights. And I had to have a doctor tell me, you're not allowed to work for this company anymore, before I gave up. That just shows my mentality. It wasn't giving up. It was, no, I was not helping. Getting out of a very, very toxic, potentially dangerous situation. This gradual attrition of confidence, ego, like, just self-belief, you know, and you, that's where the term gaslighting comes into play too, you know, and I... It doesn't just have to happen in romantic relationships, or, you know.
I think that highlights two really, really key points. The first is that quite often with bullying and also harassment, it's not like one big thing that happens. You know, it's the constant kind of picking away at someone's confidence, at their belief in themselves. Like, I've spoken to Rania recently and Vinka for the podcast, and they both highlight similar things, that like it gets under your skin. It just becomes so ingrained, and it just becomes so natural that you think it's you. And like you say, you just can't get away from it being you.
Exactly. Yeah. It's this gradual attrition of confidence, ego, like just self-belief, you know, and you, that's where the term gaslighting comes into play too, you know, and I it doesn't just have to happen in romantic relationships, or, you know,
and I think the other thing that you highlighted is that there's a real lack of safeguards against some of this, particularly, like you say, the industry is set up in such a way that often these businesses are small to medium, and there isn't that capacity for support. And the other thing that I wanted to talk about is the role of freelancers, because the wine industry has a huge amount of freelancers in it because of the way it works, and they can in particular be at risk of poor treatment, you know, whether it's in terms of pay or not being kind of collectively part of a company in the same way, not really understanding what their rights are. And I think that's really concerning for our industry, that freelancers aren't really protected.
No, and I mean, because our industry is just not a professional industry, you know, it really, really isn't. And it's interesting when Felicity Carter interviewed Rania and I the other week, she actually was like scouring online, being like, what are resources for people suffering from abuse in jobs where there's no HR? Where can freelancers go to get answers? And there's nothing there. There is nothing there. And it's partly, she was just like, how fractured our industry is, which seems like crazy. Like, I mean, the States is huge, right? Yet they seem so much more evolved in kind of having online forums and platforms and place, you know, people seem to be very transparent in how, like, I see other freelancers communicate and then like talk about issues like, well, this is how much I'm paid for doing a, you know, an event, or this is how much I'm paid for doing sponsored material, or this is where I, you know, there are these kind of pledges going around, which, you know, if you work with a company you signed up to, you will be protected against XYZ. But there's not really the equivalent in the UK, and it's been very interesting, like a real kind of positive thing which has happened from the Wine Bitch scandal has been actually the fact I think people are talking a bit more in the UK, and I actually have a regular group of freelancers who I check in with every single week. It started off just to make sure everyone was okay emotionally and just to offer support, which is very important too. But then it was just like, okay, well, how do we move forward with this? And, you know, the reason why freelancers were subject to attack in Wine Bitch was because there's no one to protect them. They're very easy targets. So, you know, now I've written that article, what I thought should happen in the industry. I wrote an article about 3 or 4 weeks ago, which appeared in the Buyer, which was really talking about the flaws of the industry and why kind of abuse and harassment can happen at every single stage of the industry. Just getting in is so difficult if you don't have the money, if you don't look a certain way. And also just how do you even hear about working in wine, like right through to the end. But I also, the kind of solution was, I was like, you know, we need to really create some kind of platform, which will probably be an amalgamation of the kind of the Drinks Trust in conjunction with other associations across, I actually think, wine, spirits, beer, pubs, hospitality, to kind of stop it being such a fractured, segmented industry. And actually also make sure that whatever board we have reflects more women, people of color, minorities. They need to be represented in this area or position of power. And we should also really think about what institutions are even necessary in their current form and really question that. And you see that now in the States with the Court of Master Sommelier. Like, I really am wondering how that organization is going to thrive and what actual organizations are really benefiting people and enhancing the industry and doing good, and what are actually just trying to keep this kind of this power of politics and this tyranny of silence and still operating. But I mean, the good news is, like, since keeping up with this group in England and since, like, you know, my articles come out and various other people are writing about it, it has absolutely put pressure on the WSAT, Drinks Trust, the Wine, Spirits and Trade Association to really think about what they could do. And I actually, even just 2 days ago, I got an email from the Drinks Trust saying that, you know, we're reforming this platform. We've just been given a grant from the National Lottery for us to be able to form a kind of interesting platform. And they're actually asking freelancers to join and be part of this platform and to actually help represent. And in an ideal world, I think it'd be amazing to have some kind of platform supported by these different associations, which offer HR resources, mentorship, networking opportunities, legal advice, grants for education and internships. You know, it needs to be like a kind of holistic approach. So by having freelancers join, even though there's no association as of yet, for freelancers, which we'd love and which we're working on, I think it's really, I've just like said, please, can I be part of it? Can I be part of the, you know, representative 2 or 3 people who are freelancers to really be part of this platform? So things are changing. I'm really excited about 2021, but, and you know, you need to have these catalysts like Wine Bitch and Court of Master Sommelier, you know, as awful as they were, at least a catalyst to these kind of discussions and movements.
Yeah, I can completely agree with that. I think, you know, horrible as they are, like you say, they shine a spotlight on it and, you know, kick everyone into gear and go, right, now is the time. We can make the change. And one of the things I really liked about your article in The Buyer is that you kind of ended it by saying that how much you love and believe in the sector and want to be a part of it, that actually what it's made you do is want to strive harder to make the sector better, not to turn your back on it. And I think that's the really important next step for everyone, is to go, no, we love it, we believe in it. Okay, let's make it better. Let's make the change happen.
And I also think on just a very personal level, it's like I actually owe it to other people entering the industry. And like I get like a lot of people emailing me like, how did you get to where you do? And da da da. da, da. And, you know, I think for me to have gone through that experience, and unfortunately I have been bullied elsewhere too in the trade and media with wine, I'm like, oh my gosh, if only I'd known this in my 20s. I actually owe it to these people entering the trade. You know, if I've been pushed through all these things and I still haven't left the industry, like, I need to give back. I need, you know, that then I'm actually turning a negative into a positive. It hasn't been for no reason why I've suffered the way I've suffered. You know, so that's just for me, like, on a very personal conscious level, like, what can I do with this? And, you know, and I always think, like, with whatever curveballs life throws, like, if you can, like, if it does just add extra, you know, experience, education, compassion, you've got to then use that. And share it with others. You owe it to them, yeah, as well as yourself. So I'm excited. And I kind of, by being in LA too, it's been interesting, kind of almost like being a bridge between the UK and LA and just seeing what's going on here and what initiatives could be implemented in the UK. I think it is important for the industry, the wine industry, as I said, like with associations across spirits and beer and hospitality. I think we've got a lot to learn. I would love to see work being done with other industries, getting in thought leaders from other industries who can also kind of maybe input and give advice how to professionalize our trade, because it is just so unprofessional. So yeah, but I just think the more that discuss things openly and collaborate and promote each other and find ways to connect, which, you know, with COVID, more and more things are online. It's never been easier to do all of those things. So it just seems like now is the opportunity. And that for me, it was why that piece, it was like, yeah, it's sad these things are happening and these are the obvious flaws, but I wanted it to be really constructive and positive and solution focused.
And speaking of being positive, I'm going to continue and power through with some positivity, because one of the things that's really been making me smile this year, talking about virtual and online tastings, is your Wine Wednesdays. Now, we're recording this on a Wednesday night in Verona, so it would be remiss of me not to ask you about your Wine Wednesdays.
Oh, thank you. Well, this is a thing. Like, it's fun. I came out second week of March to LA with a brand new visa to do anything wine and media related. So I had meetings with Universal set up and some corporate tastings. Obviously, everything shut down. So then it's like, okay, you know, like, I was like, oh my goodness, I'm living above a garage in LA, like, international pandemic. I don't want to go back to the travel ban, so I don't know if I can get back in. Like, drama, drama. So I was like, okay, pivot. And actually, one of the best, one of the best things actually, which has come out of that, is doing these Instagram lives every Wednesday. Because before, I don't think I would have had the confidence. I'm not someone who really likes looking at themselves in front of the camera. Like, I, even though I love being in front of the camera, I don't actually like looking at myself. I'm like, oh, cringe, you know. And I wasn't someone who did a lot necessarily on my stories on Instagram live, and everything's just had to change overnight. And I've found that by doing this weekly 1 hour session, it started off, I think, me just literally wine waffling and like talking about the, okay, how's everyone kind of getting through like COVID, and talking about like wine and Netflix pairings. And I think there was a sports team just playing, and what people, you know, and just really, and at the beginning of COVID too, everyone was on it. I mean, I had like 400 people just on my first Instagram live, like all kind of chipping in, and it was just something lighthearted. It actually made me feel very connected. I was, you know, I am alone in LA, I'm living above a garage, oh the glam. And it sounds really sad, sounds very sad. I am an extrovert, I do love real people in real life, but actually there was something very affirmative and enhancing, and it gave me like, it gave me a real kick, it gave me a real thrill, like just like being able to talk about wine and chat to other people who are really enthusiastic. And then, you know, I started then doing it, you know, every week. And by doing it at 6 p.m. on the West Coast, then, you know, I could still get across the whole of America. And actually, there were sometimes people up who had like insomnia in the UK or whatever. And, you know, it was always a delight when I saw like an English friend come on. But it was then that I was like, oh my gosh, you know, I can like kind of use this like to either talk about wines which are getting me through COVID, or I can then link it into maybe a particular region, because like I've been doing like online tasting, so I can maybe bring some aspects of the tastings I've been doing that week. Clients through this like open space, and I was like, this is for someone like me who is all about making wine accessible, this is the best, you know, open arena really, and it's the most interactive way and the most natural way in so many ways. So I've now kept up most weeks, and it's interesting, like I've had different people come on, whether they're winemakers. When there was the wildfires happening, I had someone from California who was like literally right like kind of in the target zone. I've had people like Jermaine come on and do wine and music stuff, just again just to make it fun. He's come on a couple of times. I've had people come on from local businesses in LA, like maybe wine bars or restaurants, just to kind of talk about the hospitality situation. I've recently of course had Rania on after our Wine to Wine webinar. And then I've also just used it for really personal stuff, like when I had to pack up my grandma's house and say goodbye to this house, which meant so much. We had to put her in a home due to dementia. And like, I went through some of the wine I found. She doesn't have a wine cellar. She keeps all her wine in the laundry room. And actually, like, one of my favorite Instagram lives is like when I actually like went through these like finds, and it was like actually a really emotional, like personal one, but it really resonated with people. And I've actually cried on Instagram for the first time ever, which I never would have thought I'd do, was when Biden was announced. And I just didn't realize how stressed, like, as having won the election, and there was just complete euphoria here in LA, and I just like burst into tears on Instagram, and I was like, I just hadn't realized how, you know, how much like this it had meant to me, and how much tyranny this country had been under, and how now there was actual real hope for actual change, you know, and just to have that possibility. I just didn't realize how amazing it was, and how much it, like, everything had been weighing on me. So again, like, I think particularly for me, which is all about making wine relatable, being engaged, you know, and actually really like actually having effective communication, being able to tap in with people and not just your own ego, having to pivot, having to do things online, doing my Instagram lives, it's actually really like, yeah, it's actually made me it's opened me up in ways professionally and also personally, and be like, oh yeah, like, you know, you can't, I always thought I was myself, you know, and my brand was me, but I really have been like tested to them and really just been so open and honest and had some quite raw moments. And it's just been amazing how people have been so supportive and responded. And that again is a testament to that wonderful unifying kind of element of wine, really. And I've just got a really lovely online community, which sounds really sad. Again, as I say, you know, I do love real life, and I love, you know, doing live events. Bring back live events, please, as soon as possible. But I don't think I'm going to, I actually am now for 2021, I'm actually thinking of how do I really capitalize on this platform? Because obviously I'm going to be in the UK at the beginning of the year, time difference and things, but I'm going to play with that kind of Instagram live model. And I've already got some ideas, kind of the formats I'll be doing and the kind of people I want to work with. So it's been very empowering. It was scary at the beginning, but ultimately it's like, yeah, it's been really empowering. Sorry, that's a really rambling answer to your question.
So I can't let you leave without obviously talking at least a little tiny bit about Italian wine, because we are the Italian Wine Podcast. And, you know, the team will kill me if we don't talk about Italian wine. So I wanted to frame it in such a way. If you were going to do a Wine Wednesday focused on Italian wine, what's going to be on your playlist for that night?
Ooh, definitely like kind of white wines from Friuli, definitely, and kind of the northeast of Italy. I love the white wines from there, and they're so underrated. I think I would also have to just have Vermentino from Sardinia, because I can't drink a glass of that without smiling, and it just reminds me of like a wonderful summer I had in Sardinia with my friends. I would also, I've been doing a lot of virtual tastings, like corporate tastings, and one of the wines which I feature on my alternative Christmas wine tasting, because, you know, it's an unprecedented time, you know, so therefore alternative wine. And one of my alternative wine suggestions for people for Christmas this year has been this amazing rosé, this natural wine rosé made from multiple Chiano from this brother and sister. It's called Moon Rosé. And I'm going to order some as soon as I get back to England, because it's just, it's kind of this wonderful pinkish orangey hue, and it tastes like rhubarb and custard boiled sweets and raspberry pavlova, but has like a savory herbal element. It's amazing. It's amazing on its own. It's great with food. So I'd have that as like the wild card, because I want to show like new wave Italian producers. So I'd have that in there. And then I think I'd have to end with an Amarone or Valpolicella from Allegrini, because Amarone is, that's the first wine I can really remember sitting down as an adult and having a full glass of with a meal with my father in Italy. And I just think it's just such a wonderful, opulent, elegant, stylish wine. So I think that's how I do it.
Nice. Yeah. Ending as well, of course, with an Amarone. We're here recording in the Veneto. So good sucking up, Amelia. Very nicely done.
Believe me, we're like the biggest Italophiles at home. We start our Christmas morning with not one, but five different kinds of panettone, because one of my dad's friends owns a panettone factory. So we have like Cointreau panettone, chocolate panettone, marron glace. I mean, it's disgusting. It's completely gluttonous. But yeah, we'll be having panettone for breakfast and Amarone, probably followed by ricotta. For our Christmas dinner.
I can highly recommend pairing your panettone with a glass of Moscato d'Asti, which to me is the perfect breakfast wine. It's 5%. It's really aromatic. It's light and fresh. It's, you know, not going to mess up your day, but it goes perfectly with that lovely citrus, the kind of aromas that you get from panettone.
The candied fruit. Yeah, that's brilliant. And it's just like such a joyous wine.
Amelia, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for taking the time to share your story on the Italian Wine Podcast. So where can people find you online for your Wine Wednesdays, your virtual tastings, all your content?
On Instagram, it's Amelia's_wine, and my website is Amelia's-wine. There has to be separation because otherwise it looks like Amelia Swine. Not a great look.
Good point.
Good point. I'm so glad my website developer told me about that. So yeah, like I always, like on my websites, that's like all my contact details, my latest blogs or my latest media is posted there, as well as future events or webinars, which I'm doing. And then on my Instagram too, I post fairly regularly there. And that's of course where my Instagram Live happens, which an Instagram Live format will be happening in the new year, but it will just be at a different time and possibly slightly different format than what I've been doing this year.
Watch this space.
Watch this space, exactly. Exactly.
Well, Amelia, thank you so much. I hope we can see you in Verona in 2021 to share a glass of Amarone together.
Yes, I would love that. That's actually where I heard my first opera was. I was 6 years old and my parents took me to the Verona Opera House to see Carmen. And I still remember it. I was too young to drink wine, but we definitely went for ice cream in the mini. Like they have a lot of intervals, start at 9, ends at 1 in the morning. And I got to see the Romeo and Juliet balcony and all of that. So, no, that was one of my earliest memories was in Verona. And I love it there. So, no, that would be wonderful.
We'll get you back here as soon as we can.
Yay! Fantastic. And thank you so much. And I hope you have a wonderful, you know, healthy, happy, festive season.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Listen to the Italian Wine Podcast wherever you get your podcasts. We're on SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Himalaya FM, and more. Don't forget to subscribe and rate the show. If you enjoy listening, please consider donating through italianwinepodcast.com. Any amount helps cover equipment, production, and publication costs. Until next time, cin cin.